Welcome to the Iktagon.
What's up, everybody? Another Iktagon coming your mother way, mother loving way, because you should love your mothers, your fathers, your brothers, your sisters, your cousins, your aunts, your uncles, your abuelos, your grandpas, your grandfathers, your abas, that's a father, your, imas, your grandmothers, your abuelas, just love everybody, your babas, love everybody, your family loving way. And Iktagon is here. My apologies to the hardcore MMA fans that follow me and did not get 1 ounce of MMA talk in the last episode. I had to review Michael Jordan's The Last Dance documentary. My apologies, not really. Michael Jordan transcends sports. He is a step above Tom Brady. If you don't know Tom Brady, just stop. He's a step above Wayne Gretzky. I don't watch hockey. I know who Wayne Gretzky is. He's multiple steps above Tiger Woods. Everybody knows these athletes. Baseball, I guess it would be Babe Ruth or Albert Pujols or Barry Bonds. Baseball is a game of shadows. Not really anybody knows who's the transcending athlete in baseball. But yeah, Michael Jordan, they put out the Last Dance documentary, and it was absolutely incredible, captivating, motivating. Just the moxie and swagger he has at his age. I assume he's in his 50s if the math is correct. And just to get to hear the man himself was amazing. Whatever he was going to say, it was just gravy. But for the director to get him to sit down for 4 to 6 hours and just recap, review intricate stories and details about his fascinating and astonishing career as a competitor and NBA champion, and all the chronicles and headlines that have followed him were just fascinating. It was an awesome documentary. I believe it's coming to Netflix soon, but if you have an ESPN membership, whether that's through your cable provider or an ESPN Plus membership, I suggest you see it. No, I'm not getting paid by ESPN. I don't work for ESPN yet. But the documentary is incredible. And what I got out of it was just the motivation. Heck, I think Michael Jordan could run for political office if he wanted to. You know, he has a lot cleaner background than the man at the helm of the United States now. He's a champion. He's a very successful entrepreneur and businessman, obviously, not only with the Jordans, but as a the fact that he could take on owning a franchise in the Charlotte Hornets in his home state is just incredible. And he doesn't give you much. And that's what I love. He's stoic when he speaks. When he does get in front of a camera, you need to listen because his words mean something. And that's what I try to do with the Iktagon. I don't try to do so much fluff. I like to have fun. But when I grill the camera and when I really try to push my words or feelings about a certain event, a fighter or a headline or a topic, it's like I want my words to mean something. And Michael Jordan drilled that home. In 2015 and 2016, to make an MMA connection, I was hanging on every single word that Conor McGregor was saying in press conferences and sit-down interviews, on radio spots, anything I could just get a hold of. It was just McGregor in 2015 and 16 was just the peak of being mentally in tune with his body and his spirit. It was just beautiful. Obviously, after 2016, we all know what happened. He got the Floyd fight and he turned into Money McGregor, and the rest is history. So I think McGregor kind of lost his way in terms of being a true martial artist and a true spokesperson of being a better version of yourself. So when I see something like the Last Dance documentary with Michael Jordan, I attracted that stuff, man. That motivational speak, the Tom Brady six. It's a ESPN documentary where they talk about the six quarterbacks that went before him, before he was selected the 199th pick in the 2000 NFL draft. And then he went on to win six Super Bowls. Just that motivating stuff gets me going. After I watched the Michael Jordan, The Last Dance, the first two episodes, the next day, I got up and went for a couple miles run. And it's just, if it doesn't get you going, if it doesn't want you to be a better competitor, a better winner, a better teammate, then there's something wrong with you. Because Michael Jordan, he's not only a great sports leader, he's just a great people leader. I could just see him in a boardroom. I could just see him over a webinar or something, and it's just his words, he means something. And you're not gonna throw smoke and mirrors and try to be swift with somebody like Michael Jordan. He will trust you, but he will immediately have his eyes locked on you like a hunter, like a predator. And he will know if you're going to work as hard as him, or knows if you're going to slack and he's going to have to push you, or if he's going to have to go separate ways from you. And I really appreciate stuff like that. The leadership aspect that I got out of The Last Dance, how him and Phil Jackson were able to balance the egos and relationships between the team, but understand the true goal, which was winning at the highest level, sports level ever. And nothing could shake that. They could be mad at each other. They could scream at each other. Somebody could have an off night. Somebody could misspeak. Somebody could be a little aggravated, frustrated, or angry. But at the end of the day, the goal was the same, to win. And to equate this to a family, what would the goal be? To be happy, to work together, to not lie, steal, or cheat from another family member. And obviously, it should go bigger than just family. It should be friends and then coworkers, colleagues. But if you're not being the best person or best version of yourself to your family, you need to check yourself. Because first of all, if you're being the best version of yourself to people outside of your family, that's awful, and that's a bad way to live your life, because you're not going to be happy. How can you trust yourself if you can't grow a full, healthy, flourishing relationship with family members who have seen you at your most vulnerable stages in your childhood, in your adolescence? There's absolutely something wrong with you. But what I'm saying is, start with your family. Work with each other, listen to each other, help each other, play with each other. The rest can just flow from there. But Michael Jordan, amazing athlete, amazing speaker, amazing leader, amazing competitor. He's a young man. He's in his 50s. He's accomplished a lot already, obviously. But I think if he wants to do something, he sets his mind. He only has one mind. I wouldn't be surprised if he had multiple minds. But if he sets his mind to it, he can do anything. So I kid, tongue-in-cheek, I speak out of the side of my mouth when I say Michael Jordan could run for a political position in office. But am I kidding? I mean, I think Michael Jordan would be not coming into the office, not only because he has better credentials than the man who's in office, but he's a way more respectable person than the man that's at the helm of this country. So, moving on. Some actual fights to talk about. No more quarantine updates. No more simple interviews. Down to the nitty-gritty. UFC Fight Night 171 happened again in Jacksonville. The UFC Jax 3 card unfolded. And what's the controversy this time? The judging. You know, we got the stoppage with Dominic Cruz. UFC 249 over a week ago. We had the whole spectacle that was no fans. That's UFC 249. The event was incredible. That's never questioned. The Wednesday, the May 13th card with Anthony Smith, we saw Jason Herzog being called to the fire. Fans, MMA fans, and MMA media did not agree with how Jason Herzog conducted the main event fight between Anthony Smith and Glover Teixeira. Reffing was the biggest topic of conversation following the May 13th card. But, so we got credible fights, a weird stoppage over a week ago for UFC 249. This past Wednesday, we have refereeing being called into question. Now whose turn is to bring controversy to themselves? The judges! Hey, welcome back. MMA's together. Everything's normal. Poor reffing. No fans, which is weird. And bad judging. Wow, we are back. We are back to normalcy, I guess, in the world of the UFC. But holy goodness, what the F happened on that card? Man, did Darren Elkins, Marlon Vera, Edson Barbosa, Angela Hill, man, did they get screwed or what? Unbelievably bad judging on that part. And you hear Dana White say it all the time, don't leave it up to the judges for this reason. Now, you may not get your win bonus. Who knows if Dana White and the UFC brass, Mick Maynard and Sean Shelby, the guys who put the fights and matchups together, if they can look past the bad judging and say, you know what, Angela Hill, Barboza, Marlon Vera, and Darren Elkins put on a hell of a performance and they barely lost, like barely lost. I hope the judges, the UFC brass can look past the poor judging, but will they? You can only hope. You can only hope. Because if I'm the UFC brass, I'm paying attention to that. And I'm making sure that Angela Hill is getting her win bonus. And Edson Barbosa is getting a win bonus. Marlon Vera and Darren Elkins. Because that was poor judging. The fight could have gone either way. Don't tell me that, oh, don't leave it to the judges. Yeah, that's a good incentive-based type of motto. And it's motivating. But not everybody has finishing power. Take, for example, Angela Hill. The fact that she even knocked down Claudia Godella to the Godella. It's a Brazilian little shit. The fact that she even knocked down Godella. No, I've said it three different times. The fact that she even knocked it down was incredible. And now you're asking her to finish her and don't leave it to the judges? That's unfair. All Claudia did was just swarm her, take her down, and control her for the first round. No doubt she won the first round. But the second and third, Angela Hill, no doubt, like I said, knocked her down in the second round and probably picked her apart and squeaked by a decision. I don't know why the judges saw it going towards Godella. Maybe they thought it was a 10-8 in the first round, but Angela Hill did way more damage, was way more active, way more aggressive, and she deserves to be in that spot that Claudia Godella is in, and that's the sixth overall spot in the UFC strawweight division. So that was very questionable, at minimum questionable. Maximum, it's Hill's win. I hope she gets paid. I hope they get compensated. But it's sad. The judging was awful. The judging was absolutely awful. So. And to come on this episode to talk about this is my friends and MMA experts, James Corrigan at Real Corrigan and Brian Fonseca at Brian Fonseca NY, both on Twitter. They're great follows, fun guys, cool guys, smart, well-spoken. You'll hear them in a couple minutes, but it was just bad. It was just bad. One of the topics that we're talking about in the green room of Zoom was, do you like these midweek fights? And I do. I do. I really do. I don't know if the UFC will do a Wednesday, a Thursday type of important UFC card. We know that PFL is on Thursday. We know that Dana White's Tuesday night contender series obviously is on Tuesday nights. And the UFCs are typically on Saturdays, sometimes on a Friday, sometimes on a Sunday, but I don't think the formula is going to change for UFC scheduling. I think once everything's back to normal, PFL on a Thursday, Dana White Contender Series on a Tuesday, and Bellator on a Friday, and UFC on a Saturday, and one championship on an early Sunday morning, I think that's plenty of fill for MMA fans to get. So what's next? What's next? Yeah, Edson Barbosa cut down to 145. His whole career has been at 155 against Dan Ige. Ige is a hell of a boxer, striker, tough guy, great technique, great footwork, great cardio, great pace. But Edson Barbosa, like I said earlier, should have won that fight. He did more damage. He had a full-on knockdown in the first round and a debatable knockdown in the second round when he punched Ige in the liver, the midsection. Did Ige fall as a strategy because he needed to buy some time, or did the shot actually send him there? No matter what, it did damage. And I'm talking about the guy who won the fight, who was falling to the floor multiple times. And maybe Barbosa didn't finish when he could have. Maybe he didn't pace himself right. Maybe he was worried about the weight cut. Maybe he was diminished when it got to the fight. Ton of factors, but on the night of the fight, Edson Barbosa did a lot more damage. Now, it's funny that this week encompassed all of MMA with judging, refereeing, and amazing fights, amazing decisions, amazing knockouts, submissions, grappling. Everything that MMA is, we saw in the past three cards. And the coolest thing was a former coworker. He was logging in to Twitter. This is at the Snide, I believe. I don't know if there's an underscore in there. People with underscores, just stop. Stop. If it's in the middle of your name, like Ike underscore CBS, that's fine. But at the end or the beginning, it's tough. I mean, you can't blame people for missing it when they're trying to find you. But Greg Snyder, who is a former colleague of mine, tuned in to the MMA fights because what the heck else is there to watch? And he tagged me on Twitter and was very curious about my thoughts about the card. And he just wanted to be part of the MMA community and the party. Who knows if it's just for one event or 1 week or 1 month. Wait till he gets to a pay-per-view card. Wait till sports come back as normal. Who knows how long he's going to stick around. But I wanted to make sure I gave a more than decent effort to try to sway him why MMA sport is the sport of the present and the future. And I'm going to put together an MMA for Dummies type of segment or Ictagon show. Maybe when things get a little dry, maybe I'll work on it piece by piece. And obviously I'm not calling Greg or anybody who doesn't know MMA a dummy. You guys all know those books with the I don't know, Max for Dummies or AOL AIM for Dummies. It's just a learning guide. But I think to play off that premise, I'm going to try to educate some of the super, super casual fans about the sport that I hold near and dear to my heart. And man, this whole thought process was flowing through my mind when I saw the poor judging. I see the poor refereeing. And I see the amazing fights. So I don't want to just make this a book for dummies like, hey, expect everything to be pessimistic and look at things glass half empty. No, no, no. I'm going to guide them what to expect with judges, referees, corners, maybe some excuses that fighters or coaches might make at the end of the fight. But I'm also going to prompt up the sport and tell them what he can look forward to with grappling when a Khabib steps in there. That, dude, you are watching the best, I'm talking to you, Greg, that you are watching the best grappler in the history of the UFC. Yeah, sorry, George St. Pierre. Sorry, Royce Gracie. Sorry, Brian Ortega, any Gracie. I'm sorry. Khabib is the most, not only dominant fighter, he's lost one round in his UFC career. One freaking round to Conor McGregor, who's a top 10 UFC fighter of all time. And he's just simply dominated everybody. He's undefeated. Nobody's undefeated. We just saw Tony Ferguson lose to Justin Gaethje after being undefeated for 8 years. Not his entire career. He was undefeated for 8 years. Khabib's been undefeated his entire career and now has the longest winning streak in the UFC. And just break down what he could see, what he should be accustomed to, whether it's a striking match. If it seems boring in the first couple of minutes, you may have to just wait for the fighters to download their opponent's footwork. And once you can understand that, it will be easier to digest the sport and not just check your phone as soon as you see two people circling for maybe 90 seconds. People check their phone. I see it all the time, whether I'm at the bar, whether I'm watching locally. If there's a, of course, if the match hits the floor, people are automatically checking their phone. But if there's a circling, like an Anderson Silva, Vitor Belfort fight, where they're just feeling out each other's distance, that's when I'm saying you should watch the most, because that's a gun duel. That's a pistol duel, whatever. That's when somebody's going to get knocked out. That's when something crazy is about to happen. So I'm going to do a segment, MMA for Dummies, and I think the artwork, you could just picture those yellow, black, and white book looking type of thing. So I think it'll be a cool segment, and that's that. My last thing before we get to James and Brian, though, in the main event of this past weekend, we saw Walt Harris, who did not fight Alistair Overeem on the December 7th card in Washington, D.C. Instead was Alistair Overeem versus Jairzinho Rozenstruik, and that fight was fun. Ended in the fifth round, I think last 10 seconds. Alistair Overeem was winning the fight, the whole fight, 24 minutes and 50 seconds. And then Jairzinho Rozenstruik coming there with a heavy looping right hook, and the rest is history. And we both see, and we see what happened to both fighters in their next fight. Jairzinho was just knocked out by Francis Ngannou over a week ago on UFC 249. One of the craziest knockouts, and even more bone chilling the fact that there was no crowd to see it. And then we saw Alistair Overeem just bounce back this past Saturday against Walt Harris in a rescheduled match. And Walt Harris is obviously has a heavy heart, and he's dealing with the loss of his daughter, Anaya. And she went missing in, I believe it's November or December, right before the fight. And he didn't fight for obvious reasons. And it's just awful. It's disgusting what some humans will do. But Walt Harris returned to his job. He put his hard hat on, and he did what he loves to do, compete, fight, and try to win. And unfortunately, the fight didn't go his way, and Alistair Overeem proves why he's one of the best heavyweights of all time. Kickboxing, grappling, Alistair's got it all, and he's always reinventing himself physically, mentally, spiritually. And it was sad to see Walt, because the whole world was rooting for him. But with Alistair, he's, like I said, reinvented himself over and over. He looked phenomenal. He got rocked early in that fight, and it was questionable why the fight was continuing, but he shows what happens if you let a fight go and let a fighter be a warrior, to quote Mario Yamasaki. You see what can happen. And Alistair Overeem proved, like I said, that he's one of the best heavyweights of all time by not only dealing with and absorbing the best shot that Walt Harris had to throw at him, but Alistair bounced back in the next round with a beautiful head kick that led to the finishing combination and for him to achieve the technical knockout by punches. But Overeem, man, can't wait to see what's next for him. Being the great competitor that he is, he welcomed Walt Harris to come to his gym and train with him. Overeem is being very genuine when he does that too, because he lost viciously to Curtis Blaydes, who's now his teammate. Curtis Blaydes, who's one of the best wrestlers at the heavyweight division, ripped Alistair Overeem to the ground and then threw the guard of Alistair Overeem, which is a John Jones type of move, was elbowing through the guard. Oh my goodness. It was about 3, 4, 5, maybe 6 elbows and just splitting open Alistair Overeem's head. And turns out that Overeem said, oh wow, this kid, he ragdolled me, he made me look bad, maybe I should go train with him. And now they're training partners. And in a recent interview with Ara Hawani, Alistair Overeem admitted that it's the best sparring partner he's ever had, and it shows that he can swallow his ego and swallow his pride and just be a great competitor, because you can't be a great competitor if you're not willing to get better and make obvious adjustments. So Alistair Overeem is one of the best at self-correcting. And I truly believe that he's being genuine when he's inviting Walt Harris to go train with him. Walt Harris trains now with a fighter who I just spoke to in Eric Anders. So they train in Alabama, SBG Alabama. But I wouldn't be surprised if Walt Harris takes a trip or two out to lovely and beautiful Denver, Colorado, where all these warriors train. Denver is one of the hot spots. It's not only the place where the UFC was founded and started, UFC 1 back in November 10th, 1993, but it's also the hotbed for fighters. There's so many gyms out there. And I don't know if I haven't spoke about this enough, but you guys could see some interviews I did while I was out there. Denver is just a gorgeous city, great people, some of them. And it was just an absolute blast to be out there. So excited to see what's next for both fighters at the main event. But the theme of the card was poor judging. And again, I hope UFC management, UFC brass, Dana White, Sean Shelby, Mick Maynard, Hunter Campbell, I hope they can all see past the poor judging and that these guys were putting their hearts on the line and being elite athletes regardless of how much they're paid compared to other sports. I just hope the UFC can see that, and I believe they will. I believe they will. So, coming up next, James Corgan and Brian Fonseca. What's up, everybody? Another Ictagon. I'm sorry I kind of drifted off track in the last episode talking about The Last Dance. You have to forgive me. I talked about probably the greatest athlete of all time, and Michael Jordan. Had to review it with my boys, David and Sam, but we are back to the fight game, back to the MMA train, maybe some boxing at the end of this, but I'm joined by my friends, colleagues. They do many stuff outside of fights, MMA, and boxing, but we connect and cross circles like a Venn diagram through the MMA world. James Corrigan, at Real Corrigan on Twitter. Brian Fonseca, at Brian Fonseca NY on Twitter. Boys, how you doing? I'm happy. No blips on your Twitter handle readings. How's everybody doing? James, I know you look like you haven't been outside in 4 months.
Oh, gosh.
What's the update, boys?
Well, I'm hoping no little kids are watching this show today. I might scare them off of watching the Ictagon show for life, but I'm good. It's great to see you again, Ike. It's been a while.
You can call me Mike if you want, man. It's been that long. I'm going to call you Jim then. I'm going to call you Jim. So we got Jim, Mike, and Ryan. Oh, what's up with you, Brian, man? How's it going?
Just staying busy in the quarantine. You know what I mean? I was working from home a lot of the times anyways. So in terms of the workflow, it's a bit of a disruption because obviously you can't go to certain places and go to certain events. Like I would normally run into you at like media day, you know, during fight week and stuff like that. Yeah. And we don't know when that's going to happen again yet. But you know, I'm optimistic that it will happen at some point and, you know, we'll get past this at some point, but right now just staying safe and doing all the things I need to do and making sure the people around me are doing what they need to do.
Cool. We obviously know, James, what he's doing, or AKA Jim's doing, but and I like it, what he's going on with the headset. He's got his cool headset. I'm still wired. I'm old school. But Brian, is that a gaming headset?
Yes, it is.
Dude, I gotta show HyperX. This to my wife.
This is what I use for everything I'm doing now. I was announcing a Madden tournament last week on a Twitch stream. It was a Madden tournament played by Navy SEALs. They were playing in a Madden tournament or whatever, right? And they were like, all right, so what do you use to record? I was like, I got HyperX, you know, industry standard video games. We out here. So they was like, all right, cool. You're good.
Amazing. And what about you, James? Is that like
the state of the art. I got the Beats. I forget exactly what it's called.
Does Dr. Dre still own those?
Or the Power Beats. Well, he sold it to Apple for
$1 billion.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Speaking of billionaires, did you guys get to see The Last Dance with Michael Jordan?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
All 10 episodes? Dude, the guys okay.
I was live tweeting.
I mean, yeah, I saw those. But yeah, I've been live tweeting UFC more and more often. I feel like this presents that opportunity. But what were you guys' takeaway with Jordan?
Oh, it's the best sports documentary perhaps of all time. Michael Jordan, fascinating on every level, and it's not just him, you know, the cast of characters, even the last episode, well, the second to last episode technically with Steve Kerr. You know, you come in there, a lot of the younger people coming in there, of course, knowing Steve Kerr as the 3-time champion coach. And
did he win 3?
No. Well, yeah, with Golden State.
They won 3? I thought it was 2. Oh, my gosh.
They won 3.
You
they
forget
won 2
the
with
first
Durant.
One.
Yeah.
They won with
the
Curry
one, yeah.
in 15.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
Just fascinating on all fronts.
I think a lot of people attracted to the worm episode, man. I didn't know he dated married Carmen Electra, dated Madonna. I heard maybe he was with Cindy Crawford. I was like, damn. No, I was like, he's not
he
weird. He's just his own style.
And you could fill a warehouse with the people who he's had relations with.
Yeah, the documentary on him, 30 for 30, they put out, I think it was last year. That's actually pretty interesting, too, when it gets into more of that, more of the Robin stuff. But, yeah, no, Last Dance was great. I think that, you know, I'm glad Jordan has a definitive piece, and I'm glad that he obviously okayed, you know, the process of this. Otherwise, it wouldn't have happened. So I'm hoping that we can get a definitive piece on someone like a Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who a lot of people, like, this is before my time, and I think that people of my generation should understand, like, how good some of those guys were, like, before we were around. Because Jordan, we know about, and even though I was born in 94, so I caught, like, you know, bits and pieces of it, and then over the years, you go back and watch stuff because YouTube, you know, came to fruition in 2005, and they got damn near everything at this point. It's harder to find some of the Kareem and Will Chamberlain and Oscar Robertson stuff, so we need documentaries on those.
You know, it was interesting because there was a question on Twitter after The Last Dance ended. Which athlete would you like to see a series of this nature?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Well, the consensus on Twitter, at least, was Tiger Woods.
Yeah.
I guess, though.
I was the only one that had my answer. I'll say that much, but I'll save it for when you're finished.
Well, Muhammad Ali, there's been so many on him already. You know,
What's
there was the
My
HBO
Name
one,
just came
the
out.
Yep. HBO one recently.
Yeah.
The Rumble in the Jungle. There was one. There was a Thriller in Manila one. But even with all that, and there was a feature film on him as well, starring Will Smith back in 2001. But if there were ever someone that could match, you know, just all the peaks and valleys, all the moments, the great moments, the cultural significance, it would have to be Ali. I think he is the obvious choice, but there's been so much on him already that, you know, what new thing could be said?
Give me Bruce Lee, man. When I saw June 7th, they moved
up.
Oh,
yeah, that's coming.
Be Like Water, I'm like, sold, man. On the Ikedagon.com website, I got a Bruce Lee quote. I'm like, give me some stuff I haven't seen yet of Bruce Lee. Like, that quote, that's what I attracted to, man. For Conor McGregor, the 2015, 2016, the 17 version against Floyd, it started to fall off. Money McGregor started to happen. But the early years, man, the quotes and everything, like, I attracted to that. Again, not so much now. But the Jordan documentary, I'm like, he's passionate. That episode where he's like, break, time out, where he's about to cry and he cuts because he's like, people don't like winning, my style of winning, they can leave. And I was like, this is inspiring, man. The next day I woke up, went for a jog. Like,
yeah,
I need more of that stuff. McGregor for me has lost it.
Yeah, and I think that we're not going to get a documentary on the person that I want to see a long docuseries on, but Vince McMahon. But I don't think we're going to get it, but I want to see one on Vince McMahon. Just give me all the Vince McMahon stuff, like the hiding steroids in the 90s, the going at it with this dude and slapping a reporter and just the Larry King stuff,
every,
just all of it.
Every week there's something on Vince McMahon. You could do one, you know, you got Owen Hart. You've got
that's coming
Montreal.
Out tonight.
Well, yeah,
is this the Dark Side of the Ring?
Dark Side of the Ring,
Dark Side of the Ring finale. That's another excellent series.
It's so good, so good.
But you can go every which way. But you think Michael Jordan was put a lid on some of this stuff, Vince McMahon? I mean, there's just no chance that, like, as his song says, there's no chance in hell.
I know. Yeah, we're not gonna. Well, Well, probably not when he's alive. We're probably not going to. He won't let it happen.
Morbid but true. Morbid but true.
Yeah.
Oh, although the Last Ride documentary on the WWE Network.
I need to see it. Don't spoil it.
That's well, no spoiler. Well, spoiler alert: The Undertaker's old. But there is some good. There are some very, very good human moments that of Vince McMahon in that show that you would not normally see.
I just heard him on with Hawani, man. This is gonna sound ignorant of me, but I didn't know how well spoken the Undertaker was. Like
that's the thing, you know. You see him walk around for 25, 26, 27 years as
I know him just as a GIF. Zombie. What's the GIF?
You know, he's there's so many. I mean, he talks like this, you know, like yeah, but yeah, he's a real life guy, and that's something that a lot of people, you know, have been taken aback by. He's been sort of in the spotlight more in recent years, but this completely pulls back the curtain.
It's sobering, really, man. Good. Like they are humans, man. Even though their personas are bigger than life, they're on the road 300 days. Like he's talking about his injuries, his hips, his knees. Like it's really breaking down his body. He's doing like almost Alistair Overeem exercises to keep his body going. And I was like, wow. It's like I like to hear more of that. I mean, I understand it pulls the curtain or breaks kayfabe. I just learned what that means, but it's like
kayfabe, yeah.
Kayfabe. Oh, isn't that? I keep saying the person that Britney Spears dated. Like,
oh wow, kayfabe.
Yes.
Who was also in the WWE for a brief period of time.
No.
Oh, God. Awful.
Oh yeah, the Umaga angle in 2006 or 7 or whatever. Cena. It was bad.
Oh my gosh. Anyway,
he got fat right after that.
Let's move into the MMA world and transition. And Ariel Helwani's been stuck on this point about he really likes it better. I played a quote on the Ike the Gon a couple episodes ago that he prefers the fans for the nuances, the hearing, the no booing if it's a boring grappling match, aka maybe the Bryce Mitchell match for some people. But for you guys, do you agree with Helwani or do you disagree?
Wow. Well, selfishly, as someone who likes to attend fights, I would prefer there be fans in the venue. But there is something to be said. You know, there is a lot of things you catch. And it's so interesting what the announcers with John Anik and then later Brandon Fitzgerald and the crew had to do was that they, especially between rounds, they had to keep their voice down. They didn't want fighters hearing what they had to say.
And like, oh man, he's really screwed. It's like, thanks, bro.
and in some cases, Anthony Smith, they were doing a hell of a lot better job than their corners were doing.
What's your takeaway, bro? Do you like it or not?
I kind of treat it like I'm watching Tough or Dana White's Contender Series, where there's, you know, not a lot of people there except for sort of the essential people, which is what you have here. So for me, it wasn't that foreign. And yeah, I kind of like it without fans in a weird way. Like, I kind of like the way it looks and sounds, but I like it in the short term. I think after a while, it's going to be like, yeah, like when we get to maybe the fall, it's going to be like, yeah, I kind of want to see people back in here, you know, when it's safe to do so. And when we get the real stuff taken care of, you don't want Conor McGregor and Jorge Masvidal, if that were to happen, for example, to happen in an empty arena instead of having 20,000 screaming fans, half of them with Irish flags and half of them with Cuban flags, maybe. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think that you want to miss out on that sort of, you know, what that could be at some point. You know, I think that with fans, it'll obviously be a better spectacle and things of that nature. But, you know, there's pros and cons to having it without fans, sort of like what James said. You can catch more stuff, just simply catch more stuff. And then the announcers obviously have to adjust. Like, it's a cool thing to sort of navigate through, at least for now in the moment while we have to.
Well, Brian, you're picking up a great point, is that MMA fans are, in some ways, they're used to seeing empty arena fights with Tough and with the Contender Series. You know,
True. We
were talking about professional wrestling a moment ago. I'll make the comparison a little bit to what's been going on with WWE and AEW in empty arenas. And it's jarring to see that. We're just not used to it. With MMA, it's something that we've seen, and it's something that we've been okay with leading up to this point. So I think that affects some perceptions.
Daniel Cormier, who obviously does the show with Ariel Helwani on ESPN MMA, he makes a fantastic point, not about the fans being there and not being, but strategically. Trevor Whitman, when he's in the corner, I'm sure you guys saw the video or the footage by now, and he's like, Justin, all right, you're here. You're in the fight. Calm down, buddy. We went through one or two rounds. I need you to take this percentage off your punches. I need you to focus and relax. Cormier says, if this is like a chaotic atmosphere that maybe Gaethje doesn't listen to his coach, he's looking over the shoulder, waiting for Tony Ferguson to get up, those punches that are winging, because you guys know the people in the top deck, they don't necessarily know if something lands or not. They know if somebody's swinging and the reaction of a fighter covering up. So maybe Gaethje's that like college type of football mentality that it's all momentum, and if he swings with the oohs and the ahs, he might get carried away. Maybe he's more exhausted and loses more energy. So in that sense, strategically, Cormier saying no fans helped Justin Gaethje because he was able to be more in control. And I was like, wow, I go, that kind of dictated. Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, you bring up a great point, because I feel like, especially a fighter.
Cormier brings up a great point.
Well, yeah. Daniel Cormier brings up a great point. You added to that great point.
He knows a thing or two about fighting.
But with Justin Gaethje, like, he's the type of dude you would figure, yes, he would feed off the crowd, because we've seen him do it before. And, you know, he's a fighter that if he lands, specifically him, then the crowd's going to go crazy. And the way he was beating up Tony Ferguson in that main event, the crowd, imagine a crowd watching that fight. I think Dana White actually said that in a press conference after the fact. He said, like, imagine, you know, having a crowd out there for this fight in particular. Now, if you do, does it go a different way? Does he try to go in for the kill in round two, and then Tony Ferguson counters at some point the way we know Tony Ferguson could, and the way we thought that he may still have as the fight continued until it didn't? Like, maybe not having the crowd sort of settle Justin Gaethje down calmed him a little bit, and instead of putting 100% on some of these punches, as you said, he would put 80. You know what I mean? And maybe that determines this whole strategy from there on out. So that's an interesting point. I think that crowd reactions, because some of the judges, and we know the judging is wishy-washy, which I'm sure we're going to get to, but like, the crowd could sway the judges very easily, especially if they're not MMA judges.
That's a great point, too. I haven't heard that.
And especially with a fighter like Justin Gaethje, who is just constantly going forward. We've seen fights where he's just 110% all the time. You know, fighters like to say that they have tunnel vision. Fighters like to say that when they're in the cage, they're, you know, locked in, they're in the zone, they're not aware of what's going on around them. But, you know, it's impossible to ignore when you've got a sold out crowd that's going crazy. It's something you do. And for a fighter like Gaethje, I thought that was the smartest fight that I've ever seen him fight.
100%.
He was picking his spots. You know, he was fighting a lot differently and a lot more wisely than he has, you know, at times normally done, even though he's picked up plenty of victories in his career. So especially for a guy like Gaethje, that worked out perfectly in his favor. Although, you know, for others, it could have been a gift and a curse.
100% agree with both of you guys' points. And I don't know what this has to do with it. I always try to, like, pick up, study behavior of fighters. I think, like, mental aspect of fighting is, like, the craziest thing. Rashad Evans has this quote, training camp is 90% physical and fight week is 90% mental. Like, it's just the visualization. You hear that from Conor McGregor and whatnot. But Justin Gaethje, for the first time, didn't jump on the fence or do the backflip or attempt to do the backflip. And was that because he fully exhausted himself in the fight? Did he fight more wise, as James says? And probably so. So, say, fast forward 3, 4, 5 months, whenever Khabib could fight, August, September, October, fans come back, hopefully. You know, we pray to whatever you pray to, and this happens, everything gets cleared up. How does Justin Gaethje do with a crowd of 20,000 against Khabib?
Oh, I think it would be 100. I think it could be a crowd of 150,000 or zero.
I love that.
And the game plan against Khabib, I don't think would change. go after him early, try and stuff the takedown, and just flip a coin from there. You're putting your life in out of your hands when you're fighting Khabib, although unfortunately for Khabib, the news about his father dealing with COVID is certainly very, very sobering.
How do you so you think no matter what, that's a Khabib victory all day?
Anybody can be had. I think that if there's one thing that we've learned from watching MMA is that nobody is impervious. Anybody can be clipped. Anybody can be beaten. Justin Gaethje can do it. He can do it. I think if he were to go after him early, we've seen Khabib get hit before. True. You know, we've seen him get waddled, but it can't go past the first. If it goes past one, I mean, it's the end.
If Khabib, Brian, your take.
Yeah, I'm just not picking against Khabib. I don't care who it is. Like, he's one of these guys where it's like, I have to see it first. I have to see him lose first if I'm going to pick against him at some point. Like, there's just Floyd Mayweather's the same way for me in boxing. Like, I'm just not going to pick against certain dudes until I actually see them lose. John Jones actually is like this for me as well, now we've kind of seen, like, maybe kind of, like...
We've seen him lose, technically, in my eyes.
Yeah, you know, so John Jones was like that. And then his last fight, I was like, oh, okay, you know, he got the decision, but did he really win? Kind of like Claudia Gadelha and Angela Hill. But yeah, I think Khabib, he's just somebody I'm not going to bet against. Like, after I saw what he did to Conor McGregor, I think he would do that to pretty much anybody, and I have to be proven otherwise.
Would Khabib forget about the Gaethje fight for whatever reason? Would Conor slide in there if Conor gets a win over the summer? I don't think now Conor and Khabib would ever fight, but if Khabib saw Conor as an opponent, it would be only because Conor's got more momentum behind him, because now he chained together two victories and he now does a WWE-like promo. Or does Khabib go the GSP route and do a November MSG fight, which I would love, man. Do it at 165
I hope we
could
have people for it. I hope we could have people for it.
We will.
But for me, it's like, I don't think he deserves another Khabib fight. Like, can he win first?
Thank you.
Like, can he just win? He hasn't fought since that fight, right?
Okay, so then answering the question. What if he does knock out Masvidal?
He's got to fight for the 170-pound title if he does.
You're too logical, James.
I don't think he beats Masvidal, though. I don't.
Well, guys.
We'll say he does. But, like, yeah, if he beats Masvidal, then, like, yeah, I can open the door to a rematch between Khabib. Because obviously,
I would
Khabib
to lock him out. I would still want Khabib to lock him out, because Conor, what he said, crossed the line like 3-4 times over about the father, the religion, the country.
Well, what's in it for Khabib also? It's like, if you beat him once, what's really in it for him? You know what I mean? Like, I at that point,
that's,
other than
that,
money.
I'm
going to
judge
money.
His character. James is totally right. He's doing the money gesture. If Khabib takes the Conor fight, it's not for legacy. You beat
does
him.
Does Khabib care about money in that way?
He says he doesn't. That's
that
what I'm
kind
saying.
Of money. I mean, you're talking about a rematch of the biggest pay-per-view fight in UFC history by far.
He's set for life, no doubt. But it's like, you know, is he going to keep to his word? Is he going to say,
I don't know. Not everyone values money the same way as we're seeing now with what's going on in America.
From a legacy standpoint, Conor could try and claim the only 3-division champion in UFC history. I think it would be smart for him, career-wise, to avoid Khabib at 155. He just at some point, you know, you could work all you want, you could talk all you want, but at some point, you just don't have the skill set to beat this guy, and that's what it comes down to.
Mentally, I would give the edge to Conor too.
Yeah,
going into
and
the rematch.
I think it's kind of like with Deontay Wilder, you know, it's like when you're a puncher and you just have the hardest hands in the division, or arguably, at least in Conor McGregor's case, you just believe that you can knock anybody out, because you pretty much can if you actually
can
connect. But I mean, that's where the belief comes from. The thing is, Khabib is different. We saw it. We saw it the last fight. You know what I mean? So I don't blame Connor for believing.
What's the sell? What, you know, he's going to sell us all. He's a salesman. He's going to be like, I was drinking, wasn't training. The same thing.
He could sell a fight. He could sell a fight between him and a 2-liter water bottle. You know what I mean?
He could buy it. He could do what Kota Ibushi did and fight a blow-up doll for any of
Kenny Omega.
For any hardcore wrestling fans out there, Kota Ibushi, actually, from New Japan Pro Wrestling, he actually did that back in the day.
Yeah.
But I don't think the other aspect of this is that it really doesn't make a lot of financial sense for the UFC to bring Conor in without fans, because the way their deal is with ESPN is they get the guarantee from ESPN. They're getting the same amount of money from ESPN for UFC 249, which did over 700,000 buys, that they are for 250, the Nunes fight, which is God knows what that's going to do. One of the weakest cards
UFC's ever
putting on pay-per-view. Conor brings in at least 10, 11, 12, maybe more than that, $1 million in the gate. Or more, if you're holding in Vegas, you got all the sponsorship money, all the casino money. You know, he brings so much more than just the buy rate for the UFC that it just doesn't make a lot of sense for them financially to have him fight without fans in attendance.
So I think we're all in agreement that the UFC will just keep that pocket aces, the Conor, the Khabib fight, whoever they fight.
Khabib, maybe, because...
They better show him that respect. They better. I mean, didn't they build an arena in Abu Dhabi for him? It's like, I know the Saudis showed Khabib the respect, but I hope the UFC does, because he is a worldwide attraction. It's like, but are we all in agreement with the reffing? We've seen Keith Peterson, the drunken, cigarette-smelling Keith Peterson with the Dominic Cruz fight. We've seen Jason Herzog with Anthony Smith. And I think, what was it, Dan Rugliotta with the Alistair Overeem fight, which I have absolutely no problem with. I think he let it go on, but I think it adds to the story. We had back-to-back-to-back fights, not in the nights, but over the week. What are you guys' overall thoughts? We got about 5 minutes. What are your thoughts about the referee? Like we've seen.
Yeah, I think the officiating has been – I don't have a big issue with it in terms of the stoppages. Like, Tony Ferguson stoppage was fine. The Walt Harris losing to Alistair Overeem was fine. The Dominic Cruz one, so it looked too soon at first, and then when I saw it back, I was like, you know what, I'm just – you know, maybe it's because Henry Cejudo retired right after, and because Dominic Cruz, we hadn't seen him in 3.5 years anyway. I was kind of like, you know what, whatever. Like, at this point, it's like – at least it's not the judging. Some of the judging, I don't know, man.
God.
The Claudia Gadelha and Angela Hill one was a bad one, man. That was a really bad one. And I'm not the punch stat guy, because I think that when it comes to punch stats, you're talking about humans actually keeping track of this. It's not some, you know, computerized 3000 system that people are tracking these punch stats on, which leads me to believe that not all of these are going to be 100% accurate. Those are hard to keep track of. However, she clearly landed more punches. She clearly landed more kicks. She clearly just fought a better fight if you just watch it, especially in what was it, rounds 2 and 3. And then you look at the faces after, and I did that one. I feel for Angela, because it's like you're trying to climb up this ladder. That would have been a big win over a former contender. You've been fighting a lot to obviously try to rise up these rankings, and then that happens.
Well, it's not just the punch that she knocked her down in the second round.
Yes.
She got the knockdown in the third round. I mean, that was the most lopsided round in terms of the punch stats. Angela Hill, the most active fighter in the entire UFC, doing so because she knows that being active means she'll get those opportunities. And yeah, that was a
she wants to fight again next week.
Yeah, that was a horrendous decision. And in the same line of the punch stats not meaning anything, look at Edson Barboza. In the end of that second round against Dan Ige, he hurts him to the body. I thought Barboza should have been more aggressive. I thought that he left something on the table there in not really charging and taking advantage of him being hurt. But at the same time, he still ended the round on top, landing hammer fists, and I just don't get it. I don't get it. The other two, there were four decisions that could have gone the other way on Saturday night. Song Yadong and Ma Olivera, that really could have gone either way.
Yeah.
Darren Elkins and Nate Landwehr also, I think, could have gone either way, even though I thought that Elkins did take that fight. It was a mess. And the refereeing, I mean, Keith Peterson, no nonsense.
No nonsense.
Previously, you know, the artist formerly known as the no nonsense, Keith Peterson. It was almost a splitting image of the TJ Dillashaw fight. Let's be honest.
That's why I look at the common denominator is Henry Cejudo. I mean, he does that cross hip hold and the gift wrap. It started with Dominic Cruz and then the hammer fist. It's like, in slow motion, I think it was about 12 unanswered strikes. I know, as Dominic Cruz said, he was making his way north. He made one knee up, but it's like, dude, you were severely losing that fight. It's like,
he was not winning that fight.
He was not winning at all. You'd rather it be too soon than too late. Exactly. I always say that. So exactly. When it comes to stoppages.
That brings you to Jason Herzog. I mean, you know, he obviously apologized at the end of that, after that Anthony Smith fight. He said that the onus is on him. But the thing is, in MMA, we're so used to just anything can happen. It's hard to – it's not like in boxing. In boxing, you know, when a guy is getting pounded for 8 rounds straight, he's not coming back. In MMA, it's different. But in the corner of Anthony Smith did a horrendous job, not just with their instructions during the fight, but with their taking care of him.
All right, boys, we're under a minute real quick. What do you want next for Francis Ngannou? Wait out for the title or push for a fight against Jones or Cormier? Real quick.
He's the next heavyweight champion.
Yeah.
Okay. And Calvin Kattar. Brian, who do you want next? Josh Emmett, Ryan Hall, Yair, a top five guy. Calvin Kattar is Yair.
Stylistically, that one intrigues me a lot.
Give me that one tonight.
Yeah.
100%. That could be a main event on the ESPN Plus card. Guys, thank you so much for the time. We got to do this next week or in the very, very near future. Again, James Corrigan, Jimmy Corrigan, at Real Corrigan on Twitter, Brian Fonseca, at Brian Fonseca NY on Twitter. Guys, thank you so much for the time. This was a flowing, easy conversation, but I don't have the premium Zoom package, so we got to cut it off. Thank you, guys. Oh,
shell out, Ike.
Brian's the man. James the man. You know who else is the man. I really enjoyed the time with them. They're really cool guys. Whenever I get to sit down and chat with them, whether it's on a media lunch, a media bus, a media scrum, they're always in great spirits. And they do many things outside of the fight game, MMA, and boxing. But you should definitely follow them on Twitter, at Real Corrigan for Jimmy James Corrigan, and at Brian Fonseca NY. Rye is his new nickname for me now. But hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I'm going to just keep the Eichtagon train going and keep tuning in. So that's it. Go enjoy your family. Later.